Hello, my friends, to another episode of your favorite spooky history podcast, Strange Origins. For this episode, I wanted to learn about a topic that has been in the back of my mind, rolling around for quite some time now. While I, like most people, have a basic knowledge of the idea of good and evil, or as some would say, of angels and demons, it took creating this episode to fully realize just how complex the mythology behind the concept was, and also just how much the concept of angels and demons has shifted through the years. While I have done an entire episode on angels, which would be a great episode to listen to after this if you haven't heard it yet, I have to admit I was actually a little more interested in learning about the history of demons. What probably interests me more is the fact that it's considered such a taboo subject, and because of that I haven't really had the chance to learn that much about it. In my book, though, knowledge is power, so the more you know about something, the less it can control you. And that seems especially true when it comes to the monsters that live under your bed. Beyond that basic interest, I've also seen quite a few movies and television shows that involve demons in some form or another. So naturally, the history of demons has piqued my interest. One of my favorite shows of late is the TV show Evil, which is about a priest, an atheist, and a psychologist who are hired by the Catholic Church to look into cases that they believe involve the supernatural. This is where I first learned about the idea of demonic lineage, which is something I will delve into later. Another great show is The Mayfair Witches, or even its companion show Interview with a Vampire, which are both based on Anne Rice novels. They both do an exceptionally good job of taking a look at the different forms of evil that can exist when it comes to dealing with demons, and especially why it's so important to never make a deal with one. Just to round off my show recommendations, I have to mention that one of my absolute favorite television shows ever written from the mind of Mike Flanagan is Midnight Mass. It's no secret that one of the main protagonists of the story is a winged creature that drinks blood and whose blood can in turn cure humans of their ailments. While the entire show revolves around religion, it is extremely intriguing that everyone who watched the show has referred to this creature as a vampire, despite the fact that the word vampire is never mentioned once by any of the characters. In my opinion, I think this is because this winged creature is meant to be a demon. And I promise you this is important to this episode because it really helps to point out just how much the concept of angels and demons has shifted through history and literature. Throughout the entirety of Midnight Mass, this creature is referred to by the priest of the show as an angel. While there are a lot of differing opinions on what this creature is, I think that everyone is correct in their assumptions. Vampires are often thought to have originated from the concept of a demon, and it's well known that demons were originally angels who fell from heaven. But enough about my theories on television shows. To really understand demonology, I need to take us back about 12,000 years or so. To narrow the idea of a demon down, one could simply describe it as an evil supernatural entity. While today they are associated with the Bible and Christianity, demons have been known to operate independently in their own separate mythology and folklore. Prominently, they are connected to natural disasters or outbreaks of disease and illness. If you want to really simplify the concept of a demon, one could state that the idea dates back to the Old Stone Age, 2.6 million years ago. It was around this time that it is believed that humans would first begin to fear the unknown. Later on, this fear would become personified, or in other words, we would attach a face to it. Anything that could hurt, curse, or kill was to be feared, whether that was a natural disaster or a plague. Just to link this back to one of my older subjects, you may recall my 14th episode, which was about witches. In that, I talked about how Egyptian healers would use pieces of ivory in order to ward against any demonic presence while women would give birth. Skipping forward a few million years, it's worth pointing out that in ancient Sumeria, in 2700 BCE, belief in demons was a guiding facet of people's lives. It's also interesting to note that a lot of their beliefs are pretty similar to modern ones. It was believed that demons resided in the underworld, which they referred to as Kerr. It was also believed that they could leave said underworld and terrorize the living. Different demons had different jobs, just as with the modern Christian hierarchy of angels. One class, called Galu, was responsible for taking certain mortals to the underworld, and these demons are often noted as being, quote, seven in number. One interesting fact about the Sumerians' belief in demons is that they could enter the world of the living through a person's dreams, through contact with the body of someone who was deceased, and most importantly, through the use of magic. Once the demon gained access to the human world, it could cause illness, misfortune, or death, which is a pretty common theme across time periods and cultures. Following the Sumerians, the Akkadians, the Babylonians, and the Assyrians would all develop their own practices and rituals that would help to keep them out of harm's way when it came to demons. A few of these practices involved prayer, offerings made of food, drink, and valuables, and spells written on clay tablets. For the Mesopotamians, the warding off of demons involved wearing amulets made of stone, metal, or even clay that depicted powerful gods or goddesses that would help to protect them. A demoness that would later bear some resemblance to the Jewish version of the biblical Lilith was the being Lamashtu. She was described in a chimera-like fashion, like a lot of ancient deities were, and was noted to have the head of a lion, the teeth of a donkey, naked breasts, a hairy body, long fingernails, and the feet and talons of a bird. Lamashtu was most famous for feeding on the blood of human babies, and was widely blamed for the unfortunate deaths of children, including miscarriages or cot deaths, which are now called SIDS. Something I found interesting about Lamashtu was that she, much like the biblical Lilith, causes misfortune independently of other demons. This may be because she was believed to be the daughter of Anu, who was considered the god of the skies and the king of all other gods. Another demon whose name survived thousands of years of history is that of Pazuzu. True crime fans might recognize the name from a case in 2012, where a Satanist who famously filed his teeth into razors was charged with murdering two men. But I don't think that guy did his history homework, because the original Pazuzu was much more of a protector than a killer. He also had chimera features, and was said to have a canine face with bulging eyes, a scaly body, and talons and wings of a bird. Along with being able to protect humans from winds bearing diseases, it's said that he was the only one who could keep the far more evil Lamashtu away from young children. People would often place amulets bearing his image near where children would sleep, or pregnant women would wear the amulets for protection from miscarriages. Looking back, it looks as though Egyptian demons were pretty similar to Mesopotamian demons in a plethora of ways. Egyptians practiced rituals to ward against demons in ways that included sacrifices and praying to specific gods and goddesses. Another type of demon in ancient Egypt was associated with the Ba, which is one of the three different parts of the soul, the other two being the Ka and the Ak, which I'm sure are terms that I have greatly mispronounced. It was strongly believed by the Egyptians that the souls crossing over to the afterlife was in part the responsibility of the living through the practice of mummification and proper burial. So unless this took place, the soul could become restless and dangerous, and therefore harmful to the living, kind of like a poltergeist or a demon. Fortunately, there were Egyptian gods who could help to restrain the powers of demons. The god Thoth, along with the goddess Isis, were thought to be masters of magic and could therefore control demons. Egyptian magicians believed that demons were attracted to either foul substances like dung or lured by things like sweet honey. Placing dung or honey near a sick patient's body was thought to draw demons out and away from them. A similar technique involved drawing images on the patient's skin of deities that were thought to be able to protect them, including Thoth and Isis, which they would then lick off in order to absorb its healing power. This is also where we see the beginning of the belief that knowing the name of a demon gave you power over it, which is something that would develop over time, especially during the medieval period. Around 3000 BCE, when the written word was finally invented, the word demon, like many other subjects I talk about on this podcast, became popular in ancient Greece. Instead of being spelled like it is today, it was instead spelled with a D-A-I at the beginning. Daimons were actually lesser spirits responsible for wielding power and deciding the fate of mortals. The general consensus states that daimons are the souls of those who have died before us and who act as guides in the afterlife. Daimons were especially noted by the Greek philosopher Plato, who described them as being the divine inspiration for his teacher and mentor Socrates. In Plato's Apology of Socrates, Socrates claimed that he had his own daimonion, which translates to mean a divine something, which warned him against making mistakes. In other words, he attributes his actions to his ability to be spiritually in tune with both his own conscience and the forces of the universe. According to the ancient Greek poet Hesiod, only Zeus had the ability to transform mortals into daimons so that they could serve as guardian spirits. He did this for a select few who were, quote, good beings who dispense riches. Nevertheless, they remain invisible, known only by their acts, end quote. Temples for these people were constructed, and protection and fortune were placed upon those who offered respect. Another Greek tradition believed that everyone had their own daimon from birth, and that the child was chosen by his or her daimon as a way of allot. Followers of Plato formed deeper theories about daimons, namely that they were created by one true god, in which case they were beings of pure intellect who were somewhere in between humans and a deity. Another theory saw daimons as angels who had fallen from heaven, and who could be at both times good and evil, both helpful and harmful to humans. This word, unsurprisingly, would translate to the modern term demon in the Bible. They are mentioned a number of times, mostly in the context of demons being banished out of possessed people. In the book of Revelations, it's famously told that when Satan was cast out into the earth, his angels were also cast out with him, and that those fallen angels became minions, in a sense. While most people hear the word demon and associate it with the Abrahamic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the basic concept behind demons has actually existed for much, much longer. According to historians, it was the demons of Zoroastrianism, the first recorded monotheistic religion in history, that trickled down to later influence Jewish demonology during the Persian era. Within the Zoroastrian faith, it was taught that there were 3,333 demons that each had specific responsibilities. These obligations ranged from all sorts of things, such as war, sickness, starvation, etc. In Zoroastrianism, a supernatural being, referred to as a deva, was defined as a, quote, god that was to be rejected. Around 3,000 years ago, in what is currently considered the country of Iran, Zoroastrianism was written about in the language of Avestan. This is why the earlier records of the religion are called the Younger Avesta. A relevant topic discussed in the Younger Avesta was the concept of the devas, which were considered divine beings that promoted, quote, chaos and disorder. Devas would later on transform in mythology into beings called divs. They are famously depicted in Middle Eastern lore as ugly, troll-like creatures. There was a strong belief in divs at the time, along with other monstrous creatures such as jinn, which are commonly referred to by Westerners as genies. These creatures also existed alongside fairies, who at this point seem to show up in every episode I talk about. They were said to have giant, human-like bodies, but with horns and teeth that resembled the tusks of a boar. They were especially said to have had a taste for human flesh and used weapons and armor, much like a modern Dungeons and Dragons type of character. Some sources stated that they were also said to be able to use sorcery to affect their enemies with nightmares. A similar creature to have originated in this way was the Arabic Shaitan. This creature is believed to be the origin of the modern term for Satan. It's worth noting that though Satan may have inherited his name from Shaitan, the two are very different from each other. The main characteristic that Shaitan and demons share was their persuasive abilities. The Arabic Shaitan was said to lure humans and even the powerful jinn into sin by whispering into their hearts. While they are considered to be invisible to humans, they are believed to be extremely ugly creatures created by fire. It was only after the Abrahamic religions became popular that discerning between good spirits and bad spirits became such a black and white idea the way it is in modern religion. Like in Greek mythology, where gods and goddesses could be both benevolent and unsympathetic, depending on the day, everything seemed to be a mixing bowl of good and bad, and somehow it all balanced out. Something interesting that religious leaders emphasized was the idea that demons were, quote, masters of deception. If you've listened to my episode on angelology, then you know that I have found that religious characters are a much more complex study than I previously had assumed. And in regards to demonology, that sentiment can be doubled. So while angels were in charge of protecting and enlightening, demons, conversely, had the job of tempting humans into doing harm both physically and spiritually. Since demons were, and still are, believed to be masters of deception and lies, this brought forth the concept that we must discern between spirits. This idea would later be called discretio spiritum. This term is used mainly in Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, and evangelist Christian theory, though I have noticed forms of it in other religions I have studied. This can be described as a special knowledge one is given that helps one to navigate whether a specific impulse is a good one or a bad one, influenced by demons. One of the best ways to discern good from evil, according to these religions, is, quote, with the assistance of grace, by the reading of the Holy Bible, of works on theology and asceticism, of autobiographies, and the correspondence of the most distinguished ascetics. And if you're wondering, like I was, what ascetics are, they are people who practice severe self-discipline. Examples of this can include religious leaders who abstain from certain worldly pleasures, such as Buddhist monks do. These people are believed to be much more in touch with angels and therefore unencumbered in the purity of their thoughts by temptation, or in other words, trickster demons. One source we still have today for our ancestors' belief in demons was in the Persian poem Book of Kings. This book was referred to as the Shahnameh, which you might recognize from my episode on scrying, where I mentioned the mythical cup of Jamshid. In this poem, which chronicled the mythic history of the Persian Empire all the way up to the Muslim conquest, there were 10 specific demons that were listed. These demons each exemplified a certain sin, much like they do in modern demonology. These sins included the well-known acts of greed, wrath, and envy, dishonor, vengeance, heresy, and even ungratefulness. There were even demons for the acts of being two-faced and telling tall tales. A famous story from the Shahnameh featuring a demon is that of a man named Rostam and his 7 quests. Rostam, after traveling with his horse and encountering plenty of trials along the way, seems to, at last, make it to the city of Mazandaran. He succeeds in killing the king of demons, who is referred to as a Div-e-Sipid, or in other words, the White Demon. Using the blood of the White Demon, he restores the sight of the ruler of Iran, who had previously been blinded by other demons, who earlier in the story Rostam was able to kill. According to a 10th century Persian historian, God first created demons, then 70,000 years later he created fairies. 5,000 years after that, he created angels, and then the jinn. Not too long after, as happens in a crowded place, these 4 creatures began to bicker and fight. In order to solve disputes between all of them, God then created Satan. Following this, he created Adam, who he gave dominion over the jinn. Later retellings of this story would exclude the existence of fairies and demons, and only include the jinn as a being that existed before humankind. Some stories even state that demons could be seen and touched before the event of the Great Flood, wherein afterward they became invisible. Something that a lot of different religions disagree on when it comes to demons is whether they were humans who passed on, or if they exist separately from humankind. At least in Muslim texts, they are both. They both exist in the liminal space away from the living, and at the same time, it is said that wicked people can turn into demons after death. Something interesting about the Middle Eastern version of demons is the way in which they must be bound. While you can't kill a div in physical combat, you can entrap it by attaching a metal object, like a horseshoe, a needle, or an iron ring onto its body. If you want to banish the div, you must find the object that stores the demon's spirit and destroy it. This is a part of the mythology that would later shape the European version of the genie, who famously is bound to its physical home of an oil lamp, or in the case of the classic show I Dream of Genie, a glass bottle. Another version of demons that I had never heard of before reading up on the subject is the Japanese Oni. Oni first popped up in the Nara period, around 710 to 794, and have become a popular figure in arts and culture since then. While technically classified as a demon a lot of the time, Oni could also be seen as an ogre due to their physical appearance, as well as the fact that they are known for living in caves or deep in the mountains. Oni are known for having red, blue, black, or yellow skin that shows that they are angry creatures and prone to violence and even cannibalism. They also feature horns, sharp teeth, and claws, and are often depicted carrying a club which they bash their victims with. Fashionably enough, they are also depicted as wearing a tiger pelt loincloth in a lot of Japanese artwork. While Oni are known to terrorize humans, they are also seen as protectors of the balance of nature, and can even be seen as a sign of luck to those who are kind to them. But as with other demons, they are also known to be tricksters and can shift into human form. A The famous myth of an Oni originated in the 14th century and is about a warrior named Minamoto no Raiko. The oldest version of the story begins with the disappearance of a large number of people from around the capital of Kyoto, most of them being women. After the court diviner determined the missing people were being taken by Oni, who lived by a famous mountain nearby, the emperor commanded that Minamoto no Raiko take a group of men to exterminate the creature. Along their way to the mountain, they encountered four deities who had disguised themselves as regular men. These deities recommended to the party that the best way to infiltrate the group of demons was to disguise themselves as Yamabushi priests, and even gave them a bottle of sleeping medicine to help kill the ogre-like creatures. Taking their advice, they left and traveled through a cave-like tunnel, where they found an old woman doing laundry by the side of the river. The old woman told them that she knew that the kidnapped girls were being taken by the Oni, killed, and their blood drained from their bodies to be used as a drink. When the warriors, who were disguised as priests, came upon the Oni, they convinced their king to give them lodging. The king, who was known for his appreciation of the Japanese drink sake, treated his guests with an afternoon drink and told them all a tale of how he and his Oni brethren had been displaced from their home in the Hira Mountains when the humans began to build a temple there. The Oni then went to sleep and were incapacitated by the medicine, which the warriors snuck into the sake. Raiko and his men then snuck into their rooms and decapitated them with their swords. Famously, the head of the Ogre King was still alive after they severed it, and it snapped its jaws at Raiko's head. Fortunately, the warrior had thought to wear three helmets on his head that night, so they returned successfully, having defeated the creature. Today, the belief in demons in Japan can be seen in not only art and literature, but also in architecture. Occasionally, you can see Japanese buildings that have L-shaped indentations at the northeast of the building that are meant to ward against Oni. These indentations are even present at the Kyoto Imperial Palace. This is because the northeastern direction is considered an unlucky direction where bad spirits are meant to pass, and has therefore been termed the Demon Gate. If you look at the zodiac chart depicting the 12 zodiac animals, you might notice that the northwest is the direction of the ox tiger, which is fitting seeing as the Oni are known for their ox horns and tiger skin loincloths. A Japanese tradition that was inspired by stories of the Oni is that of bean throwing during Setsubun, which is a festival in February. This time is seen as a shift from winter to spring, and is dedicated to cleansing oneself from the past year and looking forward to the coming season. Alongside that, it is thought to be the best time for you to be able to banish evil spirits. This is because it is believed that during this time, the spirit world is closer to the physical one, making Setsubun kind of like New Year's and Halloween rolled into one. In order to drive out demons, the practice of bean throwing is utilized during this period. While casting soybeans in and out of people's homes, people will often shout "Oni wa soto, fugu wa uchi," which means "Oni go out, blessings come in." This custom comes from the richer aristocratic and samurai classes of the 1300s to the 1500s, who took action after hearing a legend where a monk threw roasted beans into the eyes of an Oni to make them flinch and flee on Mount Kurama. Another equally interesting tradition that is more region-specific is that of spearing a grilled sardine head onto a holly branch and tying it at the entrance of a house in order to keep Oni at bay. One theory states that the smell of sardines is enough to keep the demons away, while another says that demons fear getting their eyes poked out by the sharp point of the holly branches. By far, my favorite story involving Oni in Japanese folklore is that of Momotaro, which is the story of Peach Boy. The present, pretty universally accepted synopsis of Peach Boy is that one day an old woman found a peach floating down the river and decided to take it home for her and her husband to enjoy. Once they cut into it, they discovered a little boy inside the flesh of the peach. This child told them that he had been bestowed with powers by the gods and was a blessing unto them. As the young boy grew, the couple found that Momotaro actually had powers, and was even able to cut down a large tree with just an old dull knife. When Momotaro grew into adolescence, he left home to go fight Oni, who were causing havoc near where he lived in a place called Demon Island. On his journey, Peach Boy befriended a dog, a monkey, and a pheasant, who agreed to fight alongside him in exchange for rations of his food. Much like in the story of Minamoto no Raikom, the troop succeeded in their efforts and were able to return home. While Momotaro is a relatively cute children's story, it has been used in war propaganda. During World War II, he would even pop up in cartoons and wartime films where Peach Boy can be seen donning a military uniform and fighting against the Oni that represented the enemies of the state during that time. I note this because demonology has so much to do with our modern conception of evil, whether that evil is religious, mythical, biological, or even political. Even with psychology, mental illnesses were blamed on demons, and this simplifying led to years of negative ramifications. While I do personally believe in the classic version of demons, I also know for a fact that using demonology where it simply isn't present is a dangerous road, and part of why this topic interests me endlessly. While I have been able to cover a wide range of demonology in this episode, rest assured, I still have a ways to go. Whether it is the next episode or a few episodes down the line, I want to dedicate some time to learning about medieval and modern demonology. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Strange Origins, you guys. If you don't feel like living like a monk, maybe go throw some beans out your door next February, just to be sure those pesky demons don't tickle your toes at night. Thank you so much for keeping it strange, guys. Bye.